So Psalm 78, just introducing the psalm first. The psalmist recalls the wonderful thing that God did at the time of the Exodus. That's a remembering psalm. He recalls also the recurring infidelity of God's people, which you know from the book of Exodus and the book of Numbers. In spite of God's compassion, which the psalm will talk about quite beautifully, they persisted in, quote, having no faith in God. They did not trust God's saving power. That's verse 22. That's the key problem. Therefore, they turned their back on God, they didn't listen, they behaved in certain ways, etc. Finally, the psalm will tell us, God lost patience and rejected the northern kingdom. So clearly we're dealing with a psalm that's written in Judah, remembering what happened in Samaria and the north, and saying, don't let this happen here. So it's a warning as well. The people of Judah must learn this from this, verse 7, quoting, to set their hopes on God. And obviously the same message for us. And not to forget what God has done, but to keep God's commandments. So the psalmist speaks of this psalm, he calls it a teaching, a Torah. That's the original meaning of the word Torah, a teaching. And he calls it a parable. We'll come to look at that in a moment, mashal in Hebrew. God is compared throughout this psalm, as you'll notice, to a shepherd guiding his people through the desert to pasture. In fact, that image of the shepherd is going to be all through the three psalms tonight, this morning that we'll do. Here's a quote from verse 52. Yahweh led out his people like sheep and guided them in the wilderness like a flock. God led and tended them. God guided them. God brought them to the pasture. You'll find all this in the different verses of the psalm. The psalm concludes with God choosing David as his shepherd. Verse 70, he chose his servant David and took him from the sheepfolds. That's the parable. The parable is the shepherd image. He also calls it, in verse 2, chida, which means a paradox, an enigma, something that intrigues the mind and is hard to work out. The psalmist is struggling, and this is why he calls it a chida, a paradox. He's struggling with how could the people fail to trust God after what God had done? And after the many ways in which God continued to demonstrate divine compassion, how could people be so recalcitrant, blind, deaf, unable to see? That's the problem which the psalmist is trying to deal with. In the end, tragically, God lost patience and rejected the northern kingdom, says our psalmist, choosing Judah, Jerusalem, Mount Zion, and David. So in a sense, we, the southern ones, we've been chosen. But look, they were chosen. Look what happened to them. We've been chosen. Well, don't take it for granted. We've got to learn, etc. The quote from verse 67 to 70, which we'll come back to. He rejected the tent of Joseph. He did not choose the tribe of Ephraim. Remember those words, I'll come back to them in a moment. He chose the tribe of Judah, Mount Zion, which he loves. He built his sanctuary like the high heavens, like the earth which he's founded forever. He chose his servant David. That's the quote. And now I just quote from the book of Chronicles, which is a looking back over history from the period of perhaps the 4th, 5th century, probably 400s, looking back and rewriting the books of the Deuteronomic books of Samuel, Kings, etc., looking at the whole thing again from a new perspective, a re-view of their story. And in the book of Chronicles, chapter 5, verse 2, we read, "Though Judah became prominent among his brothers, and a ruler came from him," brackets, that's David, of course, "the birthright belonged to Joseph. Joseph should have been the great inheritor, but, because of the reasons we'll hear in this psalm, failed." So the message of the psalm we're going to start reading is the people of Judah must not repeat the mistakes of their northern neighbours. Just a revision of the map that you're familiar with, I imagine, but so that's the map of Palestine. That's the map of the tribes of Israel prior to the monarchy. It's a fictional map. It's a rereading of history. You won't find any history, basically, in the Old Testament. Just forget the concept. Don't look for history. You will find some in the book of Maccabees. You'll find it's based on, like, I suppose, the stories of King Arthur. I presume there was someone, you know, King Arthur or something. But what we've got is not the history of King Arthur, is it? It's the reconstituted, people are trying to communicate to their world, and they write their history in a way to communicate values now. It's not straight fiction, but it is a reshaping according to the ideology of the day. That's the way a lot of, I suppose a lot of history is written like that. But so here you've got and the two big tribes you can see are Judah, though that's mainly desert, and this is Joseph here, the big tribe of Joseph. Joseph's two sons in the legendary history, let's call it, were Ephraim and Manasseh, were the two sons of Joseph. So that's the tribe of Joseph. As you can tell, it's the big bulk. It's the whole of Samaria. It's all that mountain district right down just north of Jerusalem, including Bethel, which is here on the border between Benjamin and Ephraim, and Shiloh and so on, and Shechem, Samaria, all of that. That's the area we're talking. So that was the bulk of the Israel. That's the kingdom of Israel. But it's Judah that's inherited the promise and Jerusalem at the time of the writing of this psalm. This is really quite nice. I don't quite know how to communicate it to you at the beginning, but you'll get the general idea of it anyhow. And if you want to wait for a little while, I will have a book on the Psalms. It's just going to the publisher soon, so by the end of the year it should be out, I imagine. It's about 500 pages, so hang on. But I mean, you'll find it. That's all I can do. I can't give it all to you now. But look at, just watch for this as we go through the psalm today. All the rich expressions for the word sin. We use the word sin a lot, but this opens up what sin can be. I'll run through them. And it's got the verses next to them. I won't read them out now. You can see them. But it talks about being stubborn, rebellious, putting your will up against someone else. The general word sinning, failing to obey, unbelieving, failing to trust, a wavering heart, unfaithful, putting God to the test, wanting God to fit into our categories, and if he doesn't, we reject it. If he does, we'll okay. So we become the deciders about whether God exists or not, according to the narrowness of our view. untruthful, provoking God, speaking out against God, grieving God. Rather beautiful. Verse 40. All those expressions you'll find as you go through this psalm, and you're getting a feel, I hope, for the psalm before we started, as one where, why are we like this? Why don't we remember? Why don't we trust? Why don't? Because we've got plenty of evidence to do it. Why don't we? The key sin, excuse me, is failing to trust God after all that God has done. Note that the focus throughout is on their personal relationship with God. It's quite significant. Not on their obedience to particular precepts. It doesn't highlight, you didn't do this, you didn't do that. It's your relationship with the mystery of God is what's at fault. That's where the problem was, which is rather beautiful and quite important. So we begin having a look at the psalm itself, which is in blue there, as you can see, and the comments are in black. Let's start. He starts with the importance of tradition. The psalmist exhorts his audience to remember the past and not do what their ancestors did. We are to remember what God has done, hope in God, and obey God. And of course, can we bring it up to date? It's not a bad idea for us to do. The Eucharist is a prayer of remembrance. Remembering is so important, isn't it? I remember when I was pretty crook, not that long, a few years ago now, but Ignatius of Loyola, his advice is always begin your prayer. It's good advice, by the way, if you want any. Always begin your prayer with gratitude. Now, sometimes that's easy. Most times it's probably hard, because you can't think of much to be grateful for if you're in a bad place or a hard place. You know, it's so dominant. But if you keep looking, remembering, you'll always find something to be grateful for. And what it does is it kind of, if you didn't look for that, the sky could become all black. You know, you tend to generalize the black that you're focusing on. Whereas remembering with gratitude means you're looking for the silver lining, you're looking for the break in the clouds, and it's there. So it stops the cloud becoming, in your imagination, totally dominant. Gratitude is a wonderful gift, and I'd be quite certain, everyone tells us this, and I could say it too, you'll never lack something to be grateful for. So if you start your prayer with that, you're already relativizing the pain and the, you know, the other things that are coming in on you. Well, let's see what our psalm now says. Give ear, O my people, to my teaching, to my Torah. That's a little use of the word Torah. It comes to stand, as you know, doesn't it, for the whole of the five books of the Bible. And then in sometimes it comes as the whole of the Old Testament. But the idea is it's a teaching, it's a way of life. But but the Torah itself, the five books, are mostly not about us at all, they're about God. They're the way God has acted in our history, and therefore the way we should respond, which are the commandments. Their perception of how human behavior should respond to God's love. And it's pretty good. It's not nearly as good as Jesus, who says, you will be my friends if you keep my commandments, you know. So there you're into the same thing. It's not conditional love. He's not saying that. He's saying, you can't be my friends if you don't keep the commandment, because the commandment is to open your heart to my love and to let the love flow through you. So if you remain closed, well, God will still keep loving, but you won't be open to it because you've chosen not to be. So keeping the commandments, not 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, so much as the commandment is love one another as I have loved you. It's very simple with Jesus. So, give ear, O my people, to my Torah, to my teaching. Pay special attention to the words I speak. I will open my mouth in a parable, a mashal. And I think the key parable is going to be the shepherd image. I will utter an ancient paradox, chida in Hebrew, enigma. Then he begins verse 3. Those things that we have heard and known, that our ancestors have told us, we will not hide from their children. We will tell the coming generation of the glorious deeds of Yahweh and his might and the wonderful things that he has done. We'll continue handing that on. I noticed something only yesterday. I was going through we've divided the parish into neighbourhood groups, the local, the geographical parish, outside which most of you are, and most of our parish council don't live in the parish. In fact, half the parish doesn't, technically. Do you know what I mean? So I can't organise that, but we have organised our own local parish. And I was incorporating from the primary school registers those people who have children at the primary school but didn't fill in the census here. It was a bit surprising to me. To you, it's probably second nature. The number of children who have saints' names was almost impossible to find. Very, very few had a saint's name. Whereas that was just, all our family had saints' names, all my generation. You don't have, and the idea was, of course, someone that you could learn about and hand on the tradition to. But all the kids now have got all these made-up names that might sound pretty and might mean nothing and might go nowhere. I'm not knocking it, I'm not taking a view of it, just to say I was just surprised at how few. So that means there's another break with the tradition. And they're not named after auntie or uncle or anybody in the family, because no one has a name like that. It's something, might be a film star, it might be a comic strip, it might be a, I don't know what it is. But it struck me as another secularizing influence that's come into our culture, and another little help to handing on tradition that we've let go, or your children have let go. And this is what he remembers, verse 5. He, that is Yahweh, established a decree in Jacob. Jacob means the whole 12 tribes, the whole country. He appointed a law in Israel. Israel was Jacob's name, given him by God. A law which he commanded our ancestors to teach their children, so that the next generation might know, the children yet unborn, and that they in turn would tell their children that they should set their hopes in God and not forget the works of God, but keep his commandments. They should not be like their ancestors, a stubborn and rebellious generation, a generation whose heart was not steadfast, whose spirit was not faithful to God. So now he goes back and remembers the past. But please note, well, I've already half said it, and I think you know it already, don't think you're getting history here. You're getting a moral teaching, and it suits the teacher to look at the negativities of the past, which were no doubt there, but out of perspective perhaps. It's saying don't do this, but it's not giving you the history of what people back then did, you know? Oh, I haven't said that clearly. The problem behind the whole mentality of the place is, and I must have told you this 100 times, if something goes wrong, God must have intended it. And since God is just, if something goes wrong, God must have seen behavior that was bad for God to punish. Do you get it? Because God wouldn't punish the innocent. That's the mentality. Therefore, they had to find what went wrong. If Samaria was destroyed, if the northern kingdom was destroyed, they must have done something terrible. If the people took a whole generation to get into Canaan at the time, well, and didn't ever come in, they died in the desert, they must have done something wrong, and God must have said right. So they kept thinking of what they would have done wrong, but what they thought up was what they wanted to tell people not to do now. Have I said it clearer now?
Yeah.
It's a projection thing. It's a preaching means that they're giving. It's not a historical record. Can't be, because it's too long ago and no one had the foggiest idea what they did. And they may have done nothing wrong, they may have all been saints. But it just happened that way, as we would see it, because God wasn't punishing anyone. It just, they were there at the time and it didn't work out, or something. I'll read you from Deuteronomy 31:29. And Deuteronomy, you know the book of Deuteronomy, I hope. It's the fifth book of the Torah. But you might know that the Deuteronomic, brackets, history, it's not really history, is the whole book of Joshua, Judges, two books of Samuel, and two books of Kings are all written by the people who wrote the book of Deuteronomy. So it's all got the same perspective, the same view of the world. And it's a success theology view of the world. If you're good, you'll do well. If you're bad, you'll do badly. So if you do badly, you're bad. If you do well, you're prosperous, then you did well. God is, and that's all around the place. In God we trust is on the American dollar, isn't it? Still. So, and it's another, it can be in all of our mentalities, shouldn't be, but it can still remain in spite of Jesus getting crucified. Which should shatter that thought, shouldn't it? The most innocent, beautiful person in the world is murdered at 23, 33 or something. So was he bad? Is that the conclusion? Was God punishing Jesus? Is that your conclusion? And people who didn't dare make that conclusion then invented a gobbledygook theology whereby Jesus did all this because we sinned. So we're the problem and God somehow punished him to save us. You've heard that. Work that out. I mean, you know, well, it's desperate theology and it's clearly balmy. How can God punish Jesus? And Jesus says, well, punish me, don't punish them. What kind of a God are we talking about, for heaven's sake? So it's got to be, it's we're all capable of looking for meaning and finding it in an unsatisfactory place because we refuse to keep thinking or we refuse to let our logical mind humbly but honestly have a look at our theology. Am I scaring you a bit or am I all right? Like there's a need to look carefully and you must bring your brain with you humbly, but bring it in. Because theology is the science of making what sense we can of the mystery. Theology should not be mysterious. Theology should be clear, should make sense, and should point us to the mystery. It doesn't hold it, but it points us there. And if we end up with a gobbledygook theology, we won't get to the mystery. We'll lose it. We'll have all images of God that are very dysfunctional. Well, let me read now, having given such a beautiful introduction to Deuteronomy 31:29. I know that after my death, says Moses in the book of Deuteronomy, well, the people who wrote the book of Deuteronomy 700 years after the time of Moses didn't have a tape recording, I can tell you, of what Moses said. This is literature. I know that after my death you will surely act corruptly, turning aside from the way that I have commanded you. In time to come, trouble will befall you, because you will do what is evil in the sight of Yahweh, provoking Yahweh to anger through the work of your hands. And the Deuteronomist wrote that because Samaria had just collapsed and the whole of Israel had gone up in flames, finished. So they had to find a reason for it. The psalm now moves in verse 9 to 11 to look at what the failure of the ancestors. Here it is. The archers of the tribe of Ephraim, we saw that just above Jerusalem, that center Samaritan high country. The archers of the tribe of Ephraim retreated on the day of battle. They did not keep God's covenant. Are you okay? Had they kept God's covenant, they would have attacked. But they retreated, so they were losing. So that's why. If that satisfies you, you might as well go home now. Because it's unsatisfactory. People, sometimes baddies win battles. They did not keep God's covenant. They refused to walk according to the Torah. They forgot what Yahweh had done and the miracles he had shown them. And Ephraim now stands for the whole of the northern kingdom. Now, what does he do? He talks about the wonderful deeds that God did in Egypt, in the Red Sea, and in the desert. Verses 12 to 16. And if you wanted to take the references to the book of Exodus and had time to and leisure to, you could read it all there in the background. This is what he's reminding the people of. In the sight of their ancestors, he worked marvels in the land of Egypt, in the fields of Zoan. The fields of Zoan was where Moses met the Pharaoh and had this big debate and turned the sticks into snakes, and you know the stories and the miracles and all that. You find that Exodus chapter 7 to 11. That's five chapters all about the marvels that God did in the fields of Zoan. Then he goes on and says, he divided the sea and let them pass through it and made the waters stand like a dike. Exodus 14:22, you know, sheets of water on both sides, you know the story, and they walked through dry shod. Wonderful. Wonderful drama. In the daytime he led them with a cloud and all night long with a light of fire. You find all that in Exodus 13:21, mentions it, but it's all the way through there. God guiding us at night by a light, and in the day it was a cloud leading them. He split rocks open in the wilderness and gave them drink abundantly as from the deep. He made streams come out of the rock and caused waters to flow like rivers. You know the story of Exodus 17 where Moses strikes the rock and water comes out. So it's picking up the well-known literature, Homeric literature. It's like Homer writing about the Troy. It's that kind of thing. Very full of wonderful images and picking up important things, but not history. In verses 17 to 20, he talks about, in spite of all these wonderful things, the ancestors rebelled. Yet they sinned still more against Yahweh, rebelling against the Most High in the desert. They tested God in their hearts by demanding the food that they craved. Remember, they wanted to go back to Egypt and eat the soup or whatever it's called, the lentils in it, and in the desert they were starving. They thought, let's go home. Slavery was a lot better than freedom. So let's go back. Numbers, I'll read for you from Numbers 11, 4 to 6, which tells you about that. The rabble among them had a strong craving, and the Israelites also wept again and said, if only we had meat to eat. We remember the fish we used to eat in Egypt for nothing, the cucumbers, the melons, the leeks, the onions and the garlic. God, they sound like they've come from southern Italy. But now our strength is dried up and there's nothing at all but this manna to look at. Okay. And you don't need me to help you. You can transpose this into our own life easily, can't we? You know, we can, with time, you just think the things that me might want. And I think the human heart seems to want everything, which is great. But we have to make decisions to get anywhere. So the temptation is to lie down at the foot of the mountain and keep all, this is a very modern temptation, I'd have to tell you, keep all your options open, lest you miss out. So there's 300 tracks up to the top of the mountain. Don't take any of them, because if you take one, you have to leave the other 299, you know. So don't take any, keep your options open, and when you're 90 and you're still at the foot of the mountain and you haven't climbed it everywhere, and you haven't committed yourself to anything or anyone, and you haven't really made a decision that locks anything off, you might find that when you come to die, you haven't actually started to live because you've never dared to take a choice, make a decision, opt for something. And I might be wrong, but I think our culture discourages commitment. Discourages it. And so it's harder for the young to make commitments when they've got all these options. Very hard for them. But without commitment, we never get anywhere. We never move. We never love. Well, the manna wasn't good enough. They wanted all this stuff, they remembered. They spoke out against God, saying, "Can God spread a table in the wilderness? He struck the rock so that water gushed out and torrents overflowed. Can he not also give bread or provide meat for this people?" Again, I'll quote you from Deuteronomy just to give a parallel here. Because the author of the psalm is calling on Deuteronomy, of course. Chapter 8, verse 14 to 16. "Do not exalt yourself." This is Moses talking. "Do not exalt yourself, forgetting Yahweh your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery, who led you through the great and terrible wilderness, an arid wasteland with poisonous snakes and scorpions. He made water flow for you from flint rock. He fed you in the wilderness with manna that your ancestors did not know, to humble you, to test you, and in the end, to do you good." The next section, the next 10 verses, verse 21 to 31, God's abundant blessings turn to destruction because of sin. I'll just read it for you. "When Yahweh heard this, he was filled with rage." Here we are back to the important theme, the anger of God. So if things are happening terrible to us on the human level, anger is often, anger meaning passionate, strong feelings of war or whatever, are against us, or parental it could be. So when things happen to us and we think in terms of God, well, mum was angry, dad was angry, my husband was angry, my wife was angry, the enemy are angry, well, God's angry, even more angry because he's stronger. Do you get it? We project onto God this image of anger. "When Yahweh heard this," and why we do it is because of dreadful things happened to us that God intended. Get it? That's the link that we can't make, but they made it. "He was filled with rage. His fury was kindled against Jacob. His anger flared out against Israel because they had no faith in God, did not trust his saving power. But in spite of this anger that God had," God is still compassionate, "so in spite of this, he commanded the skies above and he opened the doors of heaven. He rained down on them manna to eat." And you know the story in Exodus chapter 16. John chapter 6 is a whole new Eucharistic reflection on it. "He gave them the grain of heaven. Yahweh said to Moses, 'I'm going to rain bread from heaven for you.' Mortal human beings ate the bread of angels." Panis angelicus, which you can all sing for me. "Fit panis hominum, dat panis celum, figuris terminum." Five parts, you ready? So, panis angelicus, that's what it is, bread of angels, that's where the image comes from, here. "He sent them food in abundance. He caused the east wind to blow in the heavens, and by his power he led out the south wind. He rained flesh upon them like dust." These are the quails of the book of Exodus chapter 16. "Winged birds like the sands of the sea. He let them fall within their camp, all round their dwellings, and they ate and were satisfied, for he gave them what they craved. But before they had satisfied their craving, while the food was still in their mouths, the anger of God arose against them, and he killed the strongest of them and laid low the flower of Israel." What a dreadful image of God. God is angry, so he fills them all up, he fattens them up for the slaughter, and then gets them. So, don't you misbehave, children, because God will do to you what he did to them. How am I going? See the danger of some of our teaching of children when we read this and don't understand it and read it without looking at Jesus, and Jesus saying to us, it was said to you of old, but I say to you, no, this day you'll be with me in paradise. That sounds to me awfully different from this. Why didn't Jesus say to him, look at you, see, you thought you were going all right, thief, but God got you in the end, and you're getting the fruit of your life, and it serves you right, and you're damned forever. That would have sounded better, wouldn't it? Would you have been happier with that? It would have been more consistent with this psalm. But Jesus knew God, and he said, come on, come on. A whole new view of God, which is doesn't make life easier, but it makes life more loving and more responsive and more true, doesn't it? From the next section, verse 32 to 39, it's a long psalm, but it's got a lot to reflect on. This is human infidelity and divine compassion. So it's a mixed up image of God we keep getting from the psalms. In spite of all this, they still sinned. They did not believe in the wonderful things God had done. So he made their days vanish like a breath and their years in terror. He made their days vanish like a breath. So you've got this controlling God. When he killed them, he killed them. God kills people. Can you blame people for having all this mucked up idea of God in their head? They sought for him. They repented and sought God earnestly. They remembered their God was their rock, the Most High God, their Redeemer. They repented, in other words. They flattered him with their mouths, but they lied to him with their tongues. They all came back to church and genuflected and got there and got all insecure, but their heart wasn't in it. Their heart wasn't steadfast towards him. They were not true to his covenant. Yet he, being compassionate, forgave their iniquity and did not destroy them. Often he restrained his anger and did not stir up his wrath. So it's they're struggling, aren't they? You can see the psalmist is struggling. He's got this wonderful idea of God's compassion, but he's confronted with evil happening. Therefore, he has to fit in a punishing God into his image of God. Can you see the struggle in the psalm? It's going back and forth all the time to between this compassion and this anger. Love. So let me read to you on the similar idea from Psalm 111, for example. He has gained renown by his wonderful deeds. Yahweh is gracious and merciful, which our psalmist is saying here. He's compassionate. Nehemiah, in your great mercies you did not make an end of them or forsake them, for you are a gracious and merciful God. So the image is of a loving father who punishes in order to bring about a change of behavior. And all you loving fathers have done that to your children. My father certainly did to me, and I think I'm better for it. Didn't just say nothing matters, anything goes, you can do what you like. The punishment was in order to get this little puppy dog, Michael, to learn behavior that was good for him. Well, God's like that on a big scale, according to the psalmist. But actually, it's coming out of love. Isaiah 49, 10 and 13, they shall not hunger or thirst, neither scorching wind nor sun shall strike them down. For he who has pity on them will lead them, and by springs of water he will guide them. Yahweh has comforted his people and will have compassion on his suffering ones. And quite beautifully, which you love, I'm sure, Isaiah 49:15. Can a woman forget her child at the breast, or show no compassion for the child of her womb? Even these may forget, but I will never forget you. And we're right to select those passages out and get comfort from them, because they are the pure insight into the mystery of God. The others are struggling theology from a point of view that is not enlightened. So we're allowed to sniff the wind and know what's real and be a bit iffy about imperfect theological perceptions. And that's not imposing our meaning on the text. It's reading the text in the light of what Jesus revealed, which was a shock, a wonderful shock, good news, they called it, to everybody who was religious. No wonder Paul became Saint Paul when he saw that all he ever believed could be cleaned up by this insight and become a missionary thing to the world. Wonderful stuff. He wasn't picking and choosing. He was seeing what he'd never seen before, and in the light of that, able to work his way through this Old Testament scripture with clarity. Psalm 103, as a father has compassion on his children, so Yahweh has compassion on those who revere him.